Hello and welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, here with you every Tuesday at lunchtime to seek answers to questions large and small, explore the universe, and satisfy my curiosity, hopefully yours as well, dear listener. It's noon on Tuesday. This is the voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. Today, we're exploring a whole new universe. I have with me cartoonist Jim Woodring, who is the father of Frank, a cartoon that he's been drawing wordlessly in books and in artwork for 30-some years. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for having me.
Well, I am always fascinated by your work, and you do have, first of all, how many books have you actually published?
Well, oddly, I don't know. About 12, I guess, something like that.
And before that, you were doing cartoons. We'll talk about that a little bit later, but I'd like to hear about your latest book, which is called Poochie Town.
Yes, it is.
What does the title mean?
Well, in my personal mythology, to be pooched is to be disappointed in something.
Oh.
So if you're in Poochie Town, you're really up the creek.
Okay. So Frank is up the creek in Poochie Town?
Well, someone's up the creek.
Ah.
It's hard to say. It's sort of a story with wheels within wheels. You know, it's hard to nail down exactly what's going on. And as with all these stories, I write them as dictated. And then I draw them up in the way that I best think will serve the storyline. And I don't really think too much about what they're about. So my understanding of the title Poochie Town, such as it is about as far as I can take it without more information.
Well, after you record what is dictated to you, can you look at it then and say, oh, I see the storyline, I know what it's about now?
Yes. Lots of the times I can, and sometimes I can't.
But
there are stories that I've drawn 20 years ago that I don't know what they mean, but they have that resonance that tells me that they mean something. And sometimes I'll learn what a story means from somebody else who has been able to decipher the clues in it in a way that I have not.
Well, and would that not also come from the consumer's perspective? Like other forms of art, when you put it out there, it's no longer yours.
Oh, certainly.
It belongs to the person who's consuming it.
Certainly, the way they read an interaction between characters,
right,
or a character's expression or an event is totally subjective, and that's what makes it work.
So you've been doing this now for 30 plus years.
Right.
Poochie Town is around your 12th publication. You had some interesting comments about how this came about. What can you tell us about how you started this and had to restart it?
Well, it is an interesting story, but you know, talking about it on the radio is a little bit like being Edgar Bergen. It's the radio ventriloquist. So maybe if anybody has got a computer nearby, they could Google my name, Jim Woodring, and Google image that, and they'll see my cartoons, and that will make what I'm about to say make more sense.
All right, I'm doing that right now.
Okay. Well, in the late 90s, I had a sudden unsought inspiration to create a generic cartoon character. A character that wasn't a cartoon cat or mouse or dog or anything, but just a cartoon character. And I did that, and I thought he was pretty good. And then I had an invitation to produce a comic strip, and I decided to use that character. And at that point, these Frank stories just started coming to me as if dictated by an outside agency. And I'd get the ideas, and I'd work them up in storyboards, and I would draw them, and I would have a story. And it was really easy, because prior to that, all the work that I had done was stuff that I had to sketch out and figure out and draw and get right. And it was all completely, subjective. But this, I'm just doing it without even thinking about it. So it's very automatic in a way. And I instinctively know what to do and how to do it. So these stories have always been real easy for me to do.
That's incredibly enviable and somewhat mysterious.
It's very mysterious. It almost feels like, I know it's not really an outside agency. It's something within me, obviously, but it feels like it's outside. And I had this conflict with it where in 2014, I started a book called Poochie Town. And I had the whole story written up and ready to go. And I got 6 pages into it. And I thought, you know, this is like getting onto a boat for a long voyage. I want to make sure I enjoy it. I think I'll do something I've wanted to do for a while, and that is I'll have Frank leave the Unifactor, which is where these stories are set, and go to another place and get a girlfriend. So, and at that point, the voice of the Unifactor just shut down and stopped telling me what to do. Didn't give me any help, and it took me a year to work out this story. But I finally
really
got it done.
To think about this story.
Yeah,
it
really
didn't come to you.
Didn't come to me at all.
Well, Frank had been celibate for 30 years?
Well, I don't know what happened to him before I got my hands on him. I mean, he's pretty gormless anyway, so. And I don't think he was really, he was looking for, a bedmate so much as just a companion, you know? That's what I was looking for him. You know, I never even thought of that before. You put an idea into my head that's going to be hard to shake.
Oh, good.
So then when I had that story almost finished, the Unifactor came back and said, well, put this in it, put that in it. So I put these things in. And then when the story was done, I realized I had done something terrible because I had gotten Frank a girlfriend in all these previous stories. Frank had awakened with the dawn, his eyes snapped open, and he ran outside to embrace the mysteries of the cosmos. And that's what drove all the stories. And now that he had a girlfriend, he was indolent. He slept in, he read the papers, he hung out with her. You know, he didn't need a girlfriend. His girlfriend was the mother of the universe. And I had gummed up the works. And I said, oh, this is terrible, you know. I thought it was going to be like the Bobbsey twins going out and having fun, but I had, you know, killed the goose that was laying the golden eggs. But then the Unifactor came back and said, well, here's what we're going to do about this situation, and gave me a story overnight about how to get rid of her in a very dignified way. Which was to make it so that she was actually kind of a slumming goddess. And the first time he's mean to her, she goes, turns her back on him and leaves. And when he chases her down, catches up with her, tracks her down and sees her, he sees her as she actually is in her real element. And she's terrifying.
Oh.
She's this huge double page spread, terrifying. I mean, she was really a monster. And she subjected him to all kinds of terrors. But at the very end, she gave him the gift of amnesia. And he woke up and everything was just as it had been before he met her. And so then I had to start revert to the first book and do it over again. And as a penance, I had to completely draw the first six pages exactly as they were, line for line, to show that it wasn't the same story, but it was a different story. And when it takes off in a different direction, it's because the old story never happened.
Wow. Well, that story about Frank and his girlfriend sounds to me like a parody of hot romance gone wrong.
Well, actually, see, there's a scene in it. In order to get to her, there's a passage in the I Ching. I've only done the I Ching once, and it turned my life around. The passage read, two dragons wrestle in a meadow. Their blood is black and yellow. And so I had two dragons wrestling between Frank and his objective, but they were connected, and that's why they were wrestling. And he severed them. Cut them apart with the sword that he found conveniently. And then later on, when he and Fran are walking by, he sees these two halves of this previously conjoined dragon pair in an act of what looks like copulation. And they blush furiously. They're upset by it. So I don't think they're randy particularly. I think that they're just
alive.
Yeah, alive. Yeah. You know, reproduction isn't high on their list of drives.
So is Fran Frank's girlfriend?
Not anymore.
But was Fran?
Well, no, she never was. She was like, it was like one of those Norwegian fairy tales where the ice goddess consents to be the wife of a man, and the first time he tells her to get firewood, she leaves. It was like that. So was she really his wife? It's hard to say.
Uh-huh. So, but you have a book titled Fran.
Yeah, well, that was the book where I got rid of Fran. That was the book that I had to draw in order to get rid of her.
And, a whole book.
A whole 100-page book of elaborate, difficult drawings. This particular spread here, I'm showing it to Susan. You people can't see it. It's a pity. But this is Fran in her real shape. It takes up two pages. And as you can see, she's terrifying.
She's got strange big eyes in different sorts of vessels, staring at Frank, who is very tiny in her presence. And she's surrounded by all kinds of huge and somewhat threatening vegetation, but there's also a beautiful floral side to her, which to me, of course, this is this to me is about icons and the goddesses of many religions have been both terrible and nurturing. And it looks, I don't know if you meant this to happen, but it looks to me like you made Fran both terrible and nurturing, but it's her terrible side that is most prominent when she's facing off to Frank here.
I don't think she's very nurturing.
No.
I think she's pretty selfish for a celestial being.
I see. Okay.
But anyhow, I had to go through all those shenanigans just because I thought I knew better than my source of inspiration, and that nearly put me out of business.
How do you, I've heard other authors, particularly those who write, say that they have muses and their stories come to them unbidden. How do you access the unifactor that comes to you and tells these stories?
I just go somewhere where it's quiet and I put myself in a receptive position and I tell myself I'm going to write a frank story, and I write down a passage, the first thing that comes to my mind. And if it's right, it has a kind of fluorescent glow, by which I mean that it doesn't emit light, but it reflects light from an unseen source. And that lets me know that I've got it. It's kind of melting, beatific sense that this is right. And so I go on to the next one. And when I've got enough of these things that have this stamp of approval, I've got a whole story with a beginning, a middle, and end that came completely unbidden just by writing these things down. Some inner agency at work is making this stuff happen in this way.
That sounds, to really minimize it, like going into the zone. I mean, it sounds magical, but I hear so many artists say they go into the zone. It sounds to me like this is more than that.
I don't know if I know. I think I know what going into the zone means, that kind of meditative state where you're so into your work, you forget about time and everything. And it isn't really like that.
It's not.
It's really, it's almost like writing down, you know, it's like if you can almost like you can faintly hear the words, and if you listen carefully, you can hear them well enough to write them down. Mm. You know, it's really not. It's almost like that. It's hard to say. It's not like anything else I do.
How, if at all, does this translate into your personal life? Do you use this personal insight, this self-knowledge, to conduct your life?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think it's just something that happens that I'm able to capitalize on.
So the rest of the time, you're just a regular guy?
I would say so. I don't think I'm very extraordinary. I mean, I don't have an interesting life, that's for sure. I'm indoors working almost all the time. I'm very housebound. So, I mean, I do, you know, I do have a philosophical life and an inner life and all that stuff, but I don't think it relates directly to my
directly to your work.
No.
Are you a spiritual person, or do you practice a religion?
I do have a practice, yes.
Do those two ever blend?
I'm sure that they do, insofar as the things that I think about, you know, regarding the nature of the universe and the human spirit and all those things, those reflections find their way into the work somehow. I do see those issues reflected in there, but it's not done consciously.
Because when I look at your work, I see so much insight into the human condition, and you have created pages and pages and pages of this from within yourself, apparently, or the unifactor.
Well, I don't have that kind of wisdom in me. If that stuff is actually appearing in my work, and sometimes I recognize it myself, it's not coming from me. I'm not the brightest potato in the basket. I'm really not. I'm not just saying that out of modesty. I'm really kind of a fool. So something's getting through.
Something is getting through. Your books have now been distributed, and the explanations, at least the jackets, translated in for 12 or 13 different countries.
Yes.
How do you explain that?
Well, these are comics publishers looking for product. I think that's the main reason.
There's a pragmatic reason.
Yeah, but I don't know. I've never been a best-selling cartoonist, but I've always had a strong, small audience, and I guess those people exist in other countries. And it takes the right kind of publisher, a love over gold type, to publish this work, because nobody knows whether it will fly.
And apparently it has. For some time. You know, I'm a writer.
Yes.
When I'm writing or when I'm doing a radio show, I try to visualize a person who is my audience. Do you have a notion of who your audience might be?
No, I never think about that.
You never?
I mean, I'll think about it to the extent that if I think something is a little too rough or unnecessarily unpleasant, I'll take it out if it doesn't really serve a purpose. So in a general sense, I'll think I don't want to upset people unless I absolutely have to. There are bad things that happen in these stories that have to happen.
Yeah.
But I dial it back when I can. And that's about the only concession I make to my audience.
Yeah. I wasn't thinking of the audience as a censor, but more of the audience as, who am I talking to?
Well,
who,
yeah.
What kind of person is it that wants to hear what I have to say?
Well, yeah. No, I wasn't thinking of them as a censor either. I was just thinking of not wanting to brutalize anybody if I can avoid it. No, I really don't think about it. I think about getting the stories right, and then I find out later who's interested. And it's a mixed bag of people. The new book has got blurbs on it by Jeff Bridges, the actor, and
yes.
Jonathan Lethem, the writer.
Wow, very different.
So yeah, that's the range.
Yeah. You're listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, here with cartoonist and father of Frank, Jim Woodring. We can do this thanks to the generosity of Windermere Real Estate. They support all our community information programming, and they make our emergency alert service possible. We were talking about the different countries in which your wordless comics are distributed and, for lack of a better term, translated.
Yes.
And we had another person in here before we went on the air who asked the question of, how do you think these books cross cultures? And you said something about the animations. Could you tell us more about that?
Yes. About 10 years ago, I was contacted by a publisher in Japan, and they said that they knew a bunch of crazy young animators who wanted to make short animated films out of my stories. There's no money in it, but they could, you know, they would like to do that if I would let them. And I said, sure. And then when I finally saw the animations, they were done in all kinds of different styles. Stop motion, computer animation, sand animation, all this different stuff. But in every case, they had taken one of my stories and changed the storyline in a small way to make it work better. They didn't come right out and say it to me directly when I met them, but it was obvious that they thought I hadn't gotten something quite right, and they had fixed it. And I thought that was marvelous.
So they fixed it for their culture?
Yeah, for their culture, exactly.
Can you give an example? Like how one story went your way and how it might have been changed
in
another culture?
There was one story where they changed all of my perspectives, and they made it, you know how in a lot of Japanese art, the main subject of a picture will not be front and center.
Right.
Like if it's a king and his procession coming down the road, they'll show the people kneeling and just a hint of the procession coming. So I think in one case, they thought I was showing things too blatantly. So they changed all of the staging so that it was more subtle in Japanese because they felt that it made the impact of the story more powerful by being more subtly expressed.
And that would speak to Japanese culture of
yes.
the community.
Well, I assume so. At least it spoke to the culture of these people who were making the cartoons. They felt it was necessary to do
other
it right.
cultures done that? Other animators in other countries, have they done the same thing?
I've seen a few student films that people have made, but not really very much, actually.
So it was the Japanese who actually animated your stories and shifted them a little bit.
Yes, just them.
Well, and they do love cartooning and
they do.
Animation. That's
they
right.
Do.
So the Unifactor is the place where your stories come from, and it's Frank's universe.
Right. It's the universe and the creator of the universe, I've come to feel. I didn't really know what the Unifactor was until I started going against its will, and then I quickly got a powerful sense of what it was.
Where do you... So you're saying these stories come from the Unifactor, but somehow you have to relate them to human life, don't you?
Well, and yes, insofar as you're dealing with people who have problems and desires and whose desires are thwarted and whose expectations go awry and who seek experience and then are sometimes sorry that they got it. So in very general terms, it's relatable to human beings in that way.
how do people respond? What do you hear from your audience about that very thing? Like, do they tell you how they relate to Frank?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've heard a lot of that kind of thing from people who love these stories.
What sort of things do you hear?
Well, just that, you know, they feel sorry for him. They think he's a good character because he's naive, but he's not innocent. You know, they feel that there's depth and range and romance and just all the things that you find in a story that you like. They things in them are reflected in these stories and they like to see them.
Is Frank immortal?
I don't see why not.
I mean, he goes through a lot of rough stuff, but he tends to come out.
Well,
somehow.
Actually, yeah. I don't know if he's immortal, but in terms of these stories, he can't die. That's one of the main themes of these stories, is that the hammer never annihilates anybody, and everything is reset. At the end of each one of these stories, everything is reset, if not to the exact same situation that it opened at, to the moral equivalent in some way. But the order has to be restored at the end of the story, and that's something that I noticed the Unifactor was doing on its own.
Huh. Always leaving Frank ready for the next adventure.
Yes, which he always is.
Yes. What's your favorite? What was your favorite adventure of Frank's? Do you have one or two?
No, I guess I don't really have a favorite. There are a couple that I don't feel are quite up to snuff because of the way that I drew them, but it's all of a piece to me.
Oh, so it's all one big adventure.
Well, kind of. I mean, it's all one glimpses from one big situation.
The situation being?
If somebody made a series of stories about your life, it would be parts from your life. It's like that.
Ups, downs, drama. Frank gets into a lot of drama, gets into a lot of stuff that the rest of us might not.
Well, he lives in that kind of a place where things can go awry in a magnificent way in no time at all.
Would you describe Frank as hapless?
I would describe him as hapless in the sense that a holy fool is hapless. He's hapless, but it doesn't have the negative connotation of a ne'er-do-well. He's hapless because he doesn't have to have any hap. He's got the hand of the cosmos on his shoulder at all times.
And he just takes things as they come? Or he doesn't seem to be ready.
No, he doesn't. No, his curiosity drives all of these stories. Almost everything happens because he went out and looked for something, and then he found it, and then something happened. Which is what the Unifactor wants to happen. It wants him to come out and break things up and stir things up and make things happen.
Do you feel like these are lessons from the Unifactor for the rest of us?
Lessons? You know, that is a tricky question because I suppose I've learned things from these. Actually, some of the things that have come up in these stories have made me think and I've changed my behavior based on them. So I guess so. They're lessons for me. I guess they could be lessons for anybody.
What stands out for you?
Oh, I've learned a lot of things about my own selfishness from doing these stories, in fact, you know, particularly the idea that lots of times people don't like you for good reasons. That was a hard thing for me to get my mind around, but that was something I learned from the Frank comics.
Yeah, that's the hardest thing there is to learn.
One of them, at any rate.
One of those things about personal insight. And I would think that in the way that you work, you really have to be open to whatever your flaws might be. You have to open your heart, do you not?
Well, I want to know those flaws. I want to identify them. It's the hardest thing in the world for me to see where I'm going wrong. And so I'm always going wrong because I can't identify it and anticipate it. So yeah, the more flaws I can identify in myself, the better.
Because they're universal. I would guess they're universal. Those things that none of us is really that unique.
No.
Even though we are unique.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you're saying. Yeah.
So what's next? You finished Poochie Town and two other books as well that you have brought here?
Yeah. Well, the other books are those ones I was describing earlier where I had to redo them.
Ah, right.
And then I'm going to do a a bunch more, about 100 more pages of Frank stuff, and contextualize these three books in a way that will kind of do a workaround around the Unifactor. And then I just undertook to illustrate one of my favorite books called A Voyage to Arcturus.
A Voyage to Arcturus?
Yes. It's a piece of, it's a book written in 1924. It's almost universally reviled as one of the worst books ever written. I mean, worst written books ever written, because the prose style is just incredibly turgid. But it's science fiction, metaphysics, visionary, just one insanely great idea after another presented with machine gun efficiency. It's an incredible book. And it's put you in a thick, gray, sticky mood of kind of transmogrified sensuality that is just heavy. And I really love that book. And I'm hoping that by doing this lavish slipcovered illustration version of it, that it can be launched with a museum show of the drawings and contributors, but contributions by other people promoting the book. And just, I'd like to waken people up to the glories of this book. It's not for everybody, but people should know about it.
But you say it's horribly written.
It's very, very clunkily written. And the more you read it and reread it, the more you realize it can't be an accident, because it's so clunky. And I've come to think that he does this to kind of tenderize your mind and get you ready for what's coming.
Because who is the author?
David Lindsay.
And when did he write this book?
I think it was published in 1924.
Oh. So have you had to go through his estate to get the rights to do this?
Oh, no, it's in public domain.
Oh, great.
Mm, yeah.
A Voyage to Arcturus?
Arcturus. Arcturus.
Can you give us a thumbnail summary?
Well, the image that I chose for the cover has the hero, who is described in just a few lines, even though he's present on every page, as an unusually robust bearded giant. And he awakens on Arcturus after traveling there in a hard-to-nail-down way, and he's got this thing on his forehead, things growing under his ears, and a tentacle coming out of his chest. And he meets a woman who gives him a robe, and they're kind of having, it's like George Bernard Shaw with metaphysics, because it's all these dialogues between people that are meant to be for the edification of the reader, I guess. But then she has this tentacle, and she lays it around his neck, and he feels this infusion of love from her, this non-carnal, ecstatic love. It's like she's kissing him with this whip that's coming out of her sternum, and he's surrounded by all this exotic vegetation. And so that was the image I chose for the cover of this book.
How are you going to translate this very verbose book into wordless comics, or are you?
Well, it's just going to be 10 single illustrations.
Oh.
Not a comic. No, God, that would be the death of me.
Yeah.
Way, way too much. This is going to be hard just to pick 10 scenes because it's so rich.
And where will you be displaying these scenes when they're finished?
I don't know. I'm looking around for a gallery that would be interested in doing an event that was more about the book than about my illustrations. You know, the book has been championed by a lot of famous people, and if they could all pitch in and write some appreciations for it in order to, I don't know, just as a labor of love, to bring it back into the public eye.
It sounds like great fun.
It could be. I'm hoping.
So when do you anticipate you'll be finished? Do you set deadlines for yourself on this?
Yeah, I have to do it this year.
You have to do it 2019?
Yeah.
Okay. You've been listening to Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, and I have been having a fascinating conversation with cartoonist Jim Woodring, father of Frank, and his latest book is Poochie Town. Where can we get this?
Well, I'm hoping to pick some up in Seattle today, some copies of this book, and have them in the hands of the bookstall at the farmer's market on Saturday.
All right.
I told them I was going to do that. I've just found out that there may not be any books in the warehouse. I will find out today. So at some point, if I can't get them there this week, at some point the bookstore that's at the farmer's market will have them.
All right. Just here on Vashon?
Right here on Vashon.
Nowhere else in the world?
Oh, well, yes, it's in good bookstores and comic book stores and Amazon and every place that sells books. Yeah.
Poochie Town. Jim Woodring. And Jim, I can't thank you enough for joining us. Come back when you do. I'd like to hear more about The Voyage of Arcturus.
Well, if the book exists, you can pick up a copy and see if you can stand it. Thanks for having me on, Susan. It's always great to see you, and it's been a lot of fun.
It's been a delight. Thank you. And thank you for listening, folks. We're here every Tuesday at 12 noon, and grateful to the composer of our theme music. He is Luke McQuillan. Stay tuned. You never know what you're going to get on KVSH, the voice of Vashon.